Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. Mr. Dave Martino is here.
Ah, yes. I was waiting for, you know.
You're waiting for
nickname.
No name.
No name?
Yeah. Dave Nameless Martino.
Okay, there we go.
Yeah, it's actually better. Better.
Nameless Dave.
Well, today we're getting into another kind of dark mystery thriller subject matter. And the book we're talking about is new. It's called Rumor of Evil. It's a novel. It's by our guest, Gary Braver. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Alan and Dave.
Gary, so I can't help but notice that this kind of has a dark sort of situation here. So where did you come up with the idea for this book, first of all?
Okay, well, this is the first of a series. The backstory, like any crime novelist, or like many crime novelists, I have a file of really bizarre real-life crimes. And one really stuck out. You might have heard of it. It came out of 2014 in Waukesha, Wisconsin, called the Slender Man case. And it was it's really a disturbing story of two 12-year-old girls who lured another 12-year-old girl into the woods where they stabbed her 19 times. And their reason... The reason they gave to the police was they wanted to appease Slender Man, which is a faceless internet cartoon character who is kind of like an archetypal Pied Piper, goes after children. And they were afraid if they did not sacrifice their girlfriend, Slender Man would kill their families. Luckily, the victim survived the stabbing attack and the two girls are still in a psychiatric institution. That fascinated me, and even if they were brought to trial, which they weren't because they were children, or police tried to give some kind of explanation for motive, that you never really get them. And this is where, I guess, the imagination takes over. And I wanted to know what drove them to do such brutal thing to their girlfriend. I started looking up research on bullies, and I discovered that there are profiles of both the bully as well as the bullied. And the bullied is always a kind of an outsider to the adolescent norm. They're either overweight or underweight or tall and gangly, or they're disfigured in a funny way, or they talk oddly, or they have an accent, or they're from different demographic or religion or ethnic group. It's the ultimate outsider, and kids pick on them. The bully is usually a kind of an alpha kid who wants to show his or her peers that he's superior, he's powerful, and picks on this victim. So that gave me both a kind of profile of the victim and the victimizer, the bullies. And so I tried to come up with an outsider. And I came up with a 15-year-old exchange student who comes to Lexington, Massachusetts, near where I live outside of Boston, and to stay for 3 months and learn the American ways and learn the culture and share her own culture. But she is dark complexioned. She is of Roma or Romani extraction. She has really uncool kind of clothing and strange braids the size of her head. And so the kids have fun Americanizing her and introducing her to hot dogs and backyard barbecues and take her to a rock concert. And everything is going well. She's from a pig farm in rural Slovakia, and she's of this Romani extraction. And what she used to do when she was not taking care of the pigs on the farm would sometimes read palms. And so at a pizza party in Lexington, affluent Lexington, Massachusetts, she decides to read palms. And then dark things start happening to her friends and friends of the family. And that is where the rumors fly. So, yeah, she's accused of witchcraft, and the novel takes off from there.
Well, you know, I bully myself all the time. I don't know if there's any research we can do in that. No, when you're doing this, you're talking about a 15, 16-year-old.
Yeah.
How do you get into the mindset of writing that? And not only just as that being that age,
yeah,
as you're not anymore, but also being part of that age group, kind of their slang, their language,
yeah,
you know, what they think is cool and not cool. Like, how do you get into that world?
Right, right. But first, my wife and I raised two boys, and they're now adults. So they passed the teen years, and I got to know their friends and listen to their language. But for the last 45 years or more, I've been teaching at Northeastern University in Boston, and occasionally had freshman classes where kids are only 18 years old and you know, only 2 years older than Vladimir, the victim in Rumor of Evil. So I picked up the slang, the jargon, and also the mindset. And there's a kind of a paranoia that sets in to young people. They want to be accepted. They want to be part of the in group. So they are, they will be sometimes almost in a conspiratorial way invited to pick on somebody, to bully somebody. So I saw that going on throughout the high school years of my kids, even though they were neither bullied or were bullies. But I saw that happening, and also the experience teaching young people at Northeastern University. And I picked up kind of their paranoia, the language, and the sometimes really odd frame of mind that young people have and often hopefully grow out of.
Oh, yeah, well, hopefully.
Yeah.
some move on and get into politics.
You pointed up a good thing, because the conspiracy theory stuff that's been floating around for the last several years at a lower level gets really bizarre. And that whole bit about this kid is reading palms, she's a witch, she, you know, prays to Satan. She probably drinks the blood of Christian babies. So, and then they grow up and become politicians.
Yeah. That's how they get the job.
Right. You know?
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre.
It is.
When you get into this area, and because you talk about the Slender Man and you saw the original case,
yeah,
and this sort of led you down this road. Mm-hmm. So at the beginning of this, did you have it in your mind to try and explain that? Was that sort of a subtext or some sort of a meaning that you wanted people to get?
Yeah, that came after I decided that would be the backstory. And the current story is two investigating homicide cops in the Cambridge, Massachusetts area. They're investigating a woman who's hanging in her backyard. And I wanted to relate that particular, well, it looks like suicide, but it's staged. And they begin to suspect there's something behind this. And then that connects to the backstory 19 years ago, where this young girl from Slovakia fell asleep in the treehouse. You love sleeping in the treehouse. You love sleeping outdoors and looking at the stars back home in Slovakia. And one night, Halloween night, she dies in a fire in that treehouse. And that relates to the current story, which is who killed this woman in the opening paragraph. And that is a cover-up for what happened almost 20 years before. So I knew there'd be two layers. I liked the fact that a cold case could inform a current case. And so that was the kind of strategy I use and the layering.
So your characters themselves, this might sound like a little bit of a weird question, but do you have a relationship with the characters you've developed for this book?
The only relationship I had is that informs something in the book is my wife. I often use her as a model if I'm looking for a secondary female character, oftentimes either the lover of or the partner of a main male character. Kirk Lucian is one half of the detective team that investigates that woman hanging in the opening scene, and he's married to Olivia. What makes a protagonist, particularly a cop, interested is not so much, Mitch, interesting rather, is not so much detection. They've got to be smart. They've got to be able to figure things out. But it's the detective themselves. And to make them sympathetic to readers, you give them baggage. And the baggage I gave to Kirk was that a little over a year ago, before the book opens up, their daughter, his and Olivia's daughter, is killed in a hit and run accident. And they never catch the driver. And that sends them both into a deep funk. And that ended up in a separation. He was so dysfunctional in his grief and loss that he could not attend his own wife's grief and loss. And so they decided to separate. So the opening of the book, he's got this baggage. In any novel, any decent novel, there are two quests. One, the public quest, and an inner private quest. The public quest for the detective is who left that body of the woman in the opening scene. The inner private quest is, I want to get back with my wife. I want to make amends and get back to being whole again with her. These two quests, the outer quest is get the bad guy, and the inner quest is getting beyond his baggage. So that is, I did not, thank goodness, did not suffer the loss of a child with my wife, but we knew people who did. And so I kind of drew from some of those dark experiences with them.
How do you know in a story like this? Because, of course, like when you're doing this type of thriller, mm-hmm. The beginning scene, you know, you've got the hanging.
Yes.
And that, so it's kind of catches the reader.
Yes.
How do you know when to bring in the baggage, mm-hmm. and where it fits, and how much of it do you need to put in? Because you don't want it to be too much.
Exactly. I think there were 9 or 10 chapters of the flashbacks to the past. You reach a kind of an instinct where you start needing to fill in the background. And filling in the background should be dramatic, not told, kind of shown. So about 4 or 5 chapters into the book, I realized now we've got to connect this to something that happened in the past. And they're going trudging through people who knew the dead woman and questioning them and moving out to somebody else and not coming up with a very clear suspect. And then we move into the past. And once something is related in the past, kind of vaguely to what's going on in the present time, we get back and drop clues as we go along that there is something behind this woman who is hanging. But it's a kind of an instinct that, you know, you develop after having written for a while.
Well, how do you keep track of your continuity of your characters and the clues? Do you have any tools? Do you have a process?
No, I just, you know, actually, guys, I used to write outlines in the earlier novels, and it was almost like avoidance behavior. My first couple of novels had 90 pages, single space, and, you know, 3 of those and you got a book, man. and then I learned, you know, about 1/3 through the outline, I decided to take a different direction, which is far more interesting and get me to where I'm hoping the book is going to end up better. And so I just stopped doing the outlines. But what I do is I have bulleted points. This is going to happen. This has got, you know, little twists in the flow of the plot. And then I just, you know, jump in page 1. It was a dark and stormy night and see where it takes me. You know, I had the great fortune of having Robert B. Parker as my office mate at Northeastern University. And, you know, all the Spencer novels and the others and Sonny Randall. I watched him. His death was right next to mine. We were closest friends to the day he died for 40 years. In any case, I watched him demythologize the process. He would write 5 pages a day. And at the end of a year, he'd have 300 something pages. And he sent that in to his agent. And lo and behold, he had a book. But he never outlined, and almost chuckled when I used to use an outline, but he said, whatever works. But I learned that you have to trust that you have a sense of where your story is going to go in the best possible direction. So I just kind of, you know, remembered what he had done and started doing that in the last several books. And it seems to work.
Do you have a secret or a trick to, when you're in the middle of a chapter, going back to a flashback, how you write that out of current day? Like, is there something that will make a reader understand what's happening?
Yes, right. Yes, there are little clues that suggest something has happened in the past. And about a third of the way through, we have the present day homicide detectives meet up with the cop who was called in the night the treehouse caught on fire. And she says, I suspect this was not an accident or suicide. And so now we have, oh ho, so maybe there was a past act of murder. And so you drop that in at probably the third way, about a third of the way through in the present narrative, and a suggestion that something untoward has happened in the past. And I think we're going to have to go back and take up this cold case. And that's, you know, but also, once I got into the backstories, the flashback stories, I kind of wrote several of them in a row without getting back to the main tale, because that had a continuity that I knew I could move up when I needed it in the regular flow of the other, of all the other chapters. So I just knew I'd squeeze them in somehow. And that just made, the trick was making transitions from the current day story to the past story without befuddling the reader. And so it's, you know, and I befuddle pretty quickly, but I give it to my wife and say, is this befuddling? Does this make any sense? And she's a good reader, and she's like, do this, do that, yeah, to make it clearer. So
that can be a tricky thing, because you can really lose someone, and then they don't know what's going on, and then they get confused, and then
absolutely right.
Yeah,
right.
And then you can lose a reader that way. So I was just, you know, trying to get the trick, you know, so I can.
Yeah, right. But that's the benefit of having a very good agent that I have, and also good editors. So, you know, they really do have an unjaded view of it. They come into it cold and they say, wait a minute, now, this is not working. Do this, do this. And, so there's always that benefit of the outside reader.
Now, you bring in witchcraft, of course, and palm reading and all that stuff. Did you yourself do some research in that area to try and get it sound good, or are you a palm reader yourself or something? Or
No. First of all, there's nothing supernatural in the book. It's only a suspicion of something supernatural. And that's why the rumors of evil. I wrote a book a long time ago called The Stone Circle, which involved a flashback to 1692 here in the greater Boston area, both Salem, Massachusetts, and Boston, where 19 people were executed, 18 by hanging, and one by being pressed to death with stones in Boston Common. And all of them were, swear you're a witch, and we'll let you go. And one of the women, I read the transcript of the trials, the Salem witch trials, which are absolutely fascinating. And at one point, Goodwife Biddle is accused of witchcraft, and she says, I don't know what a witch is. What is a witch? You know, I think her cow might have broken through a fence and eaten someone else's hay, and someone got hysterical and said, she's a witch, she's a witch. So it was kind of, you know, scapegoating. It was the research there that helped me out in Rumor of Evil. And in fact, I even mentioned the Salem witch trials at one point, when one cop is talking to another cop, and it said, you know, these things don't change. And there's, you know, they're still screaming witch. I mean, witch hunt and all that. Now we've heard that in the news too.
Yeah, yeah, we're keeping the witch alive.
Yeah, that's right.
How do you know that your characters you're going to get into a series with them? For instance, when you get into a series, is there something about the characters themselves at the beginning, or that you know before you even start writing this book, that these are going to be a series of characters that you use?
Well, first of all, the publisher said, would you mind turning this book into a series? I said, no. I said, that's both easy and a challenge. Easy because you have a few of the main characters already in place. The challenge is trying to come up with more baggage for the main characters. As I said, that's what you try to make a character who has something the most to lose in the novel. And so that includes the two detectives in the story. The second book is called The Heat of the Moment, and that's already done. And I've now moved on beyond the husband and wife get back kind of giveaway at the end of Rumor of Evil. But the next issue is having another child. And there's a contention there between the husband and wife, Kirk and Olivia. We can't replace Megan. We're not replacing Megan. We're going to keep her memory alive and still love her. We're just going to give her a brother and a sister, or a sister. So that becomes, and then the third one, which is in the middle of right now, keeping the same characters. And I'm now working on what that baggage will be so that that private quest still is alive and working and keeping the reader endeared to the main characters. So that's the challenge of that. I mean, I cannot imagine having a tenth novel in a series and trying to come up with that personal quest. I mean, it kind of gets dissolved unless they keep on breaking up with people, or a partner gets killed in a shootout and is now guilt has come in, or, which is kind of familiar, the main character has a hang up on alcohol or drugs and is addicted. So these are some of the possibilities of down the line.
It's interesting. Do your characters ever surprise you while you're writing? Do they take the plot that you've envisioned off the rails, so to speak?
I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah. There are surprises sometimes one makes, Dave, that, I'm going along. It's, wouldn't it be interesting if he or she said this and we went in that direction? I don't know what goes on the black box of the imagination, but sometimes I'm kind of surprised at the stuff that we come up with, my characters come up with, yeah.
How is it for you writing an evil character? Do you sort of, is it something of like you like a lot? Is it kind of a favorite getting into a bad person or a bad character in a book? Or do you dislike being in that area?
That's a very good question. I think one should love one's villains. I think that if I don't think a real bad guy or a bad woman gets up in the morning and looks at the mirror and says, that is the face of evil. I think that in real life, people who do bad things to other people have sweet smelling justifications, reasons for why they do bad things. They either are envious of other people, or they did not have great parents or a great upbringing, or they're at odds with society or the law or nature. I mean, maybe they're deformed in some way or have some issues. Or with God, and they feel that they have been wronged. But ultimately, there is vengeance, revenge. I'm going to get back, and I deserve to get back because all my life I've been, and this is my way. And I'm, like I said, sweet smelling reasons of justice for me. So one of the inspirations for anyone who's writing villains is Thomas Harris's Silence of the Lambs, which is a brilliant sleight of hand on the reader because he managed to make sympathetic a psychopathic cannibal and have a lector. And you're kind of rooting for him throughout the book and even the movie version. At the end, he goes after Chilton, whatever that guy's name was, who was putting a hit on Jodie Foster. And that is ingenious. So, make him really smart, make him really classy. He's drawing pictures of the of the Duomo in Florence, or the view from the old bridge there, and Ponte Vecchio. So it's fascinating to see that happen. So you really have to love your villains, because you.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Have to kind of make flesh them out. You just can't have a bad guy because he's a psychopath and he kills people. You've got to have get in the inside. And as I said, I really believe that bad people do have inner lives. And if they're not just psychopathic, they have reasons for what they do.
Of course, you know, because in their mind, they think they're doing something good, like in their world.
Yes, exactly. They're
trying to make everything right, correct, or something. And in their world, they're going, you know, even though they can't see themselves necessarily.
Correct. From the other side.
Or you also, do you think about the violence and how you write anything kind of in a violent manner in the book itself?
Yeah, I don't like gory scenes, but the opening scene and the opening description of the woman hanging is pretty graphic. But it's also through the point of view of the cops. So because Kirk is the anchor character, a point of view character, the violence is often off stage, but it's reported to them. And so, in a sense, I spare the reader any kind of gore, but you know, the violence is there. The violence comes out in the emotional violence in the back chapters, and then in the present chapter too, that you watch people convince themselves that they have to do this because this person is evil. And so, you know, it's the heat of the moment, the heat of the emotions, that is more interesting to me than putting a noose around someone's neck or a knife in the back.
Right. Yeah. It's more interesting. So how do you deal with, because you're dealing with children in a sense, teenagers and stuff.
Right.
How do you deal with violence against them or when people are bullying them, and how far can you go? Like, would you touch child murder, for instance, in a fiction like this, a dark fiction, or do you stay away from that sort of violence toward any minors?
Yes, the violence is described kind of leading up to and then after the fact. It's the aftermath of the violence that I find interesting in terms of the reaction of the people who were behind it. I don't want to give too much away, but I have a graphic description of the fire and then the aftermath, but I don't have the agony and the horror of what takes place in that treehouse. But it's imagined, and there are enough suggestions to trigger the imagination of the reader. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those sensitive things, Matt.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you don't want to gross out the reader having a young child be, you know, brutalized. I mean,
yeah, it's kind of something you can talk about after, I guess, and it's about,
of course,
it's about the let's say how people deal with the situation rather than going through the gore and the blood and all that.
That's right, Alan. Exactly. In fact, you never see a movie where a child is being brutalized in any way or killed. I mean, it's always before or after the fact.
So characters are really key to readers, you know, because they, like Sherlock Holmes, you know, where they'll 100 years after the character is written, they go looking for the person's house when they're in England or something, you know. Yeah. I mean, people get really into characters, and that's really, in fact, they'll know the character more than they would even the writer's name, you know, at times.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What do you think the trick is to that? Like, is there something that that's key to someone going, oh yeah, and they love that character?
Yeah. I think, turning out a book with regularity the same character, and that is, you know, that's the secret of Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, all the way to, you know, Bob Parker's Spencer, you know, Dashiell Hammett's Sam Spade, and you know, Raymond Chandler's I just went blank on his name. In any case, he'll come to. But the, you know, it's the familiarity with the character, and it's like an old friend comes home when you pick up the next book. I don't, with the competition out there of so many books coming out, a couple hundred thousand a year, it's hard to make that mark without banging out a novel every 9 months or a year, and then just hoping that it catches on. But it really is the strength of the character, and just, you know, hopefully Kirk and Whit Mandy here will get some attention.
How do you create your dialogue? Do you have an inner monologue? Can you hear your characters? I know some writers say that they hear the characters, or they might read the dialogue out loud to make sure it sounds right to the ear. How do you accomplish that?
Yeah, I hear it in my head. I don't hear it out loud, but I sometimes mutter to myself, and I look for it. First of all, I have to determine, before I start a chapter or a scene, I make bulleted points. What new stuff is going to come out in this chapter? What surprises or disappointments are going to come out? And how would this chapter end? So in a sense, you kind of line up the patches of dialogue to achieve those objectives in the chapter. And then hopefully you hear the back and forth in your head and put that down. But I go over and over and over dialogue. And in reality, dialogue people don't talk like dialogue in books or even in movies. I mean, it's, you know, there's so many ums and does and, you know, just kind of, empty space of words that don't, you know, connect to much at all. So you really have to streamline it, make it sound real or realistic, and yet move the story along and hopefully, and this is the challenge, help flesh out the voice or fill out the voice of the characters who are in the dialogue. And the vocabulary difference, the expression, the slang they might use, in coupling that with the description of whoever the point of view character is, the expressions on the face, she looked scared when she was seeing this, I could tell he was lying, that kind of stuff. And in that in-between descriptive stuff, along with the language, is hopefully a good scene of dialogue. But I do hear it in my head and then polish it into it until it achieves what I'm hoping to achieve in a scene.
Right. Now, do they still let you drive when you're hearing these voices in your head?
Yeah. Good, I like that. I pull over the side of the road.
yeah. Like, you know, it's like, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway. Well, it's quite a process. Do you have some sort of thing? Is there something you want people to get out of the book, or is it just entertainment?
Well, the first 8 novels were medical thrillers, and so it goes right back to Frankenstein, Watch Out What You Wish For. This is also kind of a Watch Out What You Wish For here, but it doesn't have the scientific stuff, I mean, inventing, coming up with a serum that would prevent you from aging, which I did in Elixir, or boosting the intelligence of children in Gray Matter. So, but this does have a kind of a moral Watch Out What You Wish For. Be nice to people.
Too late.
Because you can't tell, they might be a witch.
Yeah. You never know. You turn into like a frog or something, right?
Yeah, there we go.
It's certainly got a lot. It's a lot more than Bewitched, right? Right. I mean, it's a little bit more darker than that.
Yeah.
So when you're doing a series with characters and stuff like that, you already got the second one done and you're going into a third. So do you kind of know where it's going to end in your head?
Yeah, usually I do know where the story is going to end. And some people will be living happily ever after, and some people will be either behind bars or in the ground. So I know that truth and justice has got to win out, but there are oftentimes tragic endings, even though justice prevails. The main character has to kind of lose something a little bit and come out of it with a sense of he's sadder and wiser at the end. So that is kind of probably the way my novels end. Sadder in a sense that, particularly for the cops, they witness such brutality, and wiser, you know, maybe in their own lives, how they've rectified some of the situations of their baggage. But I usually know generally how it's going to end, who's going to make it, who's not going to make it. It was interesting. The last book I did was called Choose Me with Tess Gerritsen. It did very well. And we know each other for 25 years, and she had a Christmas party, asked me if I want to write a book with her. And I said, give me a nanosecond to think this over. And so we were 2/3 through the book, and Tess called me and we were talking. Who's the villain? We had set up five suspects, each of whom had a reason to commit the crime, but we couldn't decide which one to go with. And it was a matter of, we're going to have to, this is like dropping a pebble in a still pond. We're going to have to go back and change everything when we finally decide who this is going to be. And she said, how about character A? I said, no, that character A cannot be a bad person. It's got to be character B. And so went back and forth and finally decided on character B, and then had to go back and line up all the ducks. So it is it's a matter of sometimes you don't quite know how it's going to end. But in a detective novel, I mean, it's driven by clues and logic and solving a puzzle. And it immediately invites the reader to second guess the author and try to solve it and say, oh, I saw this coming, or be surprised at the end. And so you have to, you're really trying to manipulate the truth in the book and drop red herrings to distract them, but not pull a rabbit out of a hat at the end and say, oh, I see why this person is the villain. So everything falls into place. But that's tricky business. But if it's done right, it's kind of fun and satisfying.
Yeah. If you can get it out. Yeah. When you mentioned justice prevails, is this sort of kind of why you would write fiction? Like when you come across the Slenderman idea and you hear about it, you're kind of wondering in your mind, well, what would cause this? What goes on with the bully and what goes on with all of this stuff? And you're putting it all together. I mean, you could have went a nonfiction way. You could have went after the real story and got into it and found characters and stuff. Right. But do you do a fictional version of a story because you can make justice prevail?
Yes, exactly. That's just well said, too. Yeah. I mean, real crimes are grubby. They're pretty awful. I mean, and so the difference between life and literature is literature has to make sense. And so when I take a crime story and fold it in, put it through my squeeze box and put it into a novel, I try to make sense out of it. That's why you stay away from psychopaths, you know, serial killers, because they kill because of love and killing. There's got to be something behind that in a book. In real life, it may not be. There's just some loose screw someplace. So you try to make sense so that it makes at least literary or fictional sense for why terrible things happen, as opposed to the grubbiness of real crime and a very clear lack of motive or understanding and baffling police. I did a lot of research using real cops in local police departments here, and they see some of the worst crimes this side of a war zone. And I remember saying, what keeps you from gnawing on your Glock or braiding a noose? I mean, how do you stay sane seeing senseless crime? He said, well, every 6 months we have psychological training. We go and get mentors or talk to friends. And cops usually talk to people in blue. They don't usually talk to your next door neighbor and say, I'm really struggling. So it is in a book, you really have to even deal with some of that some of the baggage might be just being overwhelmed by the horrors of what they experience wearing a badge.
Oh yeah, that's a big part of it. I've done 30 books on fiction, and you talk to the cops and you get them. I get them involved because it's more about the process.
Yes.
And yeah, there's no real, and justice, I will say, quite often doesn't prevail. So that's kind of the issue. Sure. Like you can make the bad guy get what they deserve in a fiction, where sometimes, quite often in nonfiction, it doesn't really happen, or it happens really late.
And that was the attraction to me of having a cold case. We solved the case; it's almost 2 decades old, and so that is to me kind of gratifying. But you know, I'm controlling the real world, making it up as I'm going along. So yeah.
Well, while you're at it, we've got a lot of repairs for you to do with the real world. there's some. You got a heavy load ahead of you. This is not light lifting here.
I pass on that one.
Yeah, this is heavy, heavy work here.
Right.
You know? Oh, it's crazy. But, well, that's interesting. So, what do you like most about a book? Like when you read a book, so when you're reading a book, what keeps you reading to the end? What is it that you go, wow, this is great, I love this, and you stay with it? Can you identify kind of what the things are that are great in a book?
Sure. I think there are three things. One is the quality of the characterization of the characters. I mean, how they're fleshed out. And two, a kind of narrative thrust that the book moves well. And three, not rushing so much, but that are action scenes and reflection scenes. And the reflection scenes is where you get the characters, get a sense of who they really are. And good language. I mean, I'm an English professor, a former English professor, and I like novels that are well crafted and use good language, fresh language, original metaphors, whatever. And so I'm looking for those three or four things. One of the most gratifying thing when someone reviews my book is when they say this was well crafted, this is well written. That to me means an awful lot. And I think that is true of other writers also. That praising them not only for having good characters, good story, and a real nice pacing to it, but good use of language, good language skill.
Well, as a university professor, does academia look at popular fiction differently now? Now that there are, I know you've taught horror fiction and science fiction and different types of genre.
Right.
Or is there still kind of, you know, this poo-pooing of genre fiction? Or has the perception changed?
Oh, I don't think there's much poo-pooing of genre fiction. I mean, mysteries are still the most read genre there is. Probably second would be thrillers. I think that the thing that bothers me as an English teacher, former English teacher, is a self-publishing. There's been a sea change in publishing in the last 20 years. And with self-publishing, I find that the lack of editors and the lack of books being represented by an agent means they don't get the kind of thing that I mentioned earlier, having a second reader say, I think you should work on this. And, you know, that there is a kind of, I don't know how to put this without being unkind, kind of a dumbing down of the genres because they've not been vetted by agents or editors. And I've even had students who have self-published and, they'd come to you with a manuscript and they would you go over to see, I'll go over it with you and then say, I think you got to go through this again. But they would publish it anyways with, you know, they pay $1,000, $2,000 to get something self-published, and still not well written. Too many of the usual blunders, like having four points of view in the opening paragraph. You know? So, and you know, by the way, Louise Penny, who was, you know, a mega star, she does that. And I think Canadians, which she is, and Europe, English people from the UK use multiple points of view, whereas American novelists usually anchor a scene in one character's head. You could have seven different characters in a mystery or a thriller tell their scenes, tell their chapters, but switching back and forth in the same scene is jarring to a reader. He's jarring to me, but Louise Penny has got 10 million followers and I don't.
You got to be careful. Canadians are, you got to, don't
turn
your
back. Yeah, they
can take it
away. Seal the border.
Yeah. The old Canadians are building a wall. They started in 2016. That's terrible. Yeah, they're dangerous people. Well, it's all good. So listen, speaking of followers and stuff, do you have like a website? Do you have like social media? Where do you like readers to find you?
Okay, www.garybraver.com. That's my website. And they can pre-order the book from there. They can pre-order the book from Amazon, Kobo, Barnes & Noble. An Amazon page is already up, and there, you can buy right there. As I said, from my website, garybraver.com, there are a bunch of buttons that they can click if they want to get themselves a book.
Buttons. Well, and it's the editor's pick.
Yeah. I'm thrilled. I really am.
Bring out the book. Well, doesn't that put pressure on you in a sense? Like, do you feel like, oh my God, all of a sudden now they've got this banner.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fabulous start and fabulous recognition, and I'm so certainly very appreciative. I think it puts pressure on to dump more, do as much as I can, which I have been doing, as much as I can to get the word out about the book. I've got a lot of you guys and you, Alan and Dave, you know, interviews like this, which are wonderful. And bookstore events coming up. We have the launch next Tuesday in Lexington, where in fact several scenes in the book take place. But, you know, trying to get through signings, and it's kind of a roller coaster, but you have to do it. And what Tess Garrett and I missed when Choose Me came out is everything was done by Zoom. We did not sign a book with real people. So now that the pandemic is kind of behind us, I'm looking forward to meeting readers and giving talks here or there and then signing books to real people right in front of me. that's part of what, you know, I'm trying to set up as best engagements as possible. Yeah.
It's always good to get out, and it's much easier. It's crazy when you've got, like, when the pandemic's on and everything's shut down.
Yeah,
nobody knows what to do, kind of, and how to do it. But,
exactly.
You know, hey, it's what goes on. It's what we got to live with.
Exactly. And hopefully that's behind us those days. And people are just squares on a screen, you know. I taught classes with, you know, for a year and a half, like what we're doing now. And it was, you see these poor kids sitting in their beds with their laptops looking miserable because they can't go across campus and have a coffee or a beer with one of their pals. I mean, it was pretty awful. So,
Well, I'd be laying in the room drinking the coffee and the beer.
Ditto.
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, and it's changed the interview world. I mean, from what used to be a pretty full-time studio job to, like, almost nobody goes to the studio anymore.
Right. That's right. Right? Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And it's cheaper. A lot of writers and even entertainers, they just do everything by Zoom. They sit in an office and do 5 or 6 interviews a day, and it's cheaper than flying and hotels. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We have a lot of empty buildings in Boston, in fact, too, the corporations that don't have anyone working there anymore.
I bet.
The business world is hurting, yeah.
Yeah, it's a new world.
It is, yeah.
Anyway, well, we appreciate you being here. We'll have your book and website, everything up on ours, so people can find you easily.
Great.
Now, the book we're talking about, Rumor of Evil, and that's a novel. Gary Braver, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Gary.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.